Hey, everyone. In this episode, I talk with Alicia Sutton on her podcast, 50 Now What? We delve into the portrayal of rape in the Bible and how it's handled within the church. It's a heavy topic, but Alicia and I, we approach it with honesty and open discussion. While the subject matter is serious, I believe our conversation offers valuable insights. This bonus episode is a companion to our last episode, hashtag MeToo, sexual assault in the Bible.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to 50 Now What? I'm your host, Alicia Sutton. I'd like to welcome back my friend Jessica Botiford onto the podcast. As well as being a producer and playwright, she is also a fellow podcaster and joins us today to discuss her new project, the Bible Rewind Podcast. Each episode of the Bible Rewind covers and challenges different topics found in the Bible, as discussed by experts and historians, to serve as a starting point for further exploration. In this episode, we discuss both of our personal histories with religion and the Bible before focusing on the subjects covered in the Bible Rewind podcast, sexual assault and rape in the scripture and church culture. Jessica takes us through examples of stories in the Bible that enable problematic rhetoric the church upholds to this day, and how that has personally affected both of us as we navigated growing up in such an environment. As a courtesy to my listeners, while I find these conversations very important, there will be explicit conversations of sexual assault and rape in this episode. Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
Hello. So glad to have you here with us from the Bible Rewind podcast. I've been looking forward to our conversation. And this is going to be a deep conversation. But before we get into it, Jessica, why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about you and your journey to developing your podcast, The Bible Rewind?
Well, so I like to say things like I've been a Christian since I was in the womb. At least I've been going to church since I was in the womb. And when I was a kid, I did not quite buy everything the Sunday school teachers were telling me. I questioned a lot of the stories. And not because I wanted to be like anti, I just didn't believe them. But I always did believe in God. And so I had to reconcile my feelings with the Bible and some of the stories, and then my personal feelings as a Christian. And then one day I was in my apartment complex at the gym, and there was another young woman there, and we were like in our late 20s, and she was studying theology at the University of Emory. And I was telling her that, oh, you know, I'm going to start using the skills I learned in theater school and I'm going to apply them to the Bible. So one of the things we learned in theater school was script analysis. And script analysis is when you take a script, you read it, but then you also start analyzing, like, where did the author come from? What was the political situation when the script was written? Did the author live near the ocean? You start analyzing all these things that could have affected the script. And I said, I'm going to start doing that with the Bible. Where did the Bible come from? Who wrote it? What was the political situation and things like that? When I told her I was going to do that, and she's like, oh, that actually exists. It's called exegete. And I said, what? And then I looked up the word exegesis and started getting into that and found out that there's plenty of people who basically they were analyzing the Bible in the same way I would analyze a script for theater. And that really helped me reconcile the stories and the sort of inconsistencies that I found in the Bible and helped me understand why they exist. And that's the information I want to share with the people in the podcast, The Bible Rewind.
I absolutely love that. And you and I have spoken before, and you know where my position is on a lot of different things, and it's always a joy to have this conversation with you. So I'm so glad to have you here. And specifically today, we're talking about, there's so much. You have such a broad scope of information that comes from your podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about the translations and the interpretations as it relates to curating of the church culture, as it relates to sex, sexuality, and sexual abuse and rape that occur in the church. And just to preface to my listeners, I'm not at all a Bible scholar. Jessica is our resident understanding. I'm going to give it to you anyway. I know you're saying no, but you know more than me. So there's that.
I like to talk to Bible scholars.
And we'll get into that because you have a lot of information in that regard. But before we get into the real depth of that specific topic, as you talked about with regards to the translation of the Bible, what is the Bible supposed to be an interpretation of? What is its original text? I always thought it was the Sumerian tablets, but what is the Bible translating? Where does it come from?
So when you read Genesis, like the first stories in Genesis, they have this really epic feeling. So many things are happening. And then when you think about just how stories begin and how culture begins, a lot of it's just through word of mouth. So when we're looking at the first stories in the Bible and just the Bible altogether, they started off as a collection of stories that were orally passed down. And then eventually somebody was like, hey, we should write this. And different people started writing the stories. And then people started to compile the writings and try to make them flow. And then people started translating the writings. And then people started making, you know, the writings make sense for their personal cultures. And so that's how we get to the Bible we have today. I think one of the misconceptions, or, you know, I don't want to say misconceptions, but one of the things that we learned in the church is that the Bible is like from God to man, very similarly to the Book of Mormon. You know, Joseph Smith was sitting out in the woods one day and had a vision and boom, he wrote the Book of Mormon. But that's not actually how the Bible was written. It's very possible that the stories were inspired by God, but then men came together, they wrote it down. They also edited the stories. They compiled the stories. They did all these things to the stories. And when all the stories were written, somebody had to translate them. Somebody had to add the chapters. And where do the chapters go? Where do the verses go? All of that, those things were decided by human beings. And that's what we have in our hands today. So this is why a lot of like Christian scholars are saying the Bible was inspired by God. But to say the Bible was written by God or edited by God, you know, that's humans did that. Yeah.
Right. And like you said, and I'm glad that you pointed it out, if humans are the ones, we are the ones who are actually editing this Bible, it is still open to individual translations, and those fall in line with, you know, I think it would be naive to say that even the editing would be negated by whomever was the overseer of that editing and have it to suit their interests, their culture, and where, you know, where we're seated at the time. And correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not sure which is the most used translation. I grew up with the King James Version. I know it kind of crosses over into, is that the main one, or I know there are others as well in the years?
I think the King James is the main translation that's used by so many people because of Great Britain's colonialism. So they, wherever they colonized, they brought their Bible with them. But there are so many new translations now, and oh, so many. So I don't really read the New King James Version because it doesn't sound like how I speak. The versions that I read the most are the NIV New International Version. And then there's another Bible, which is, I think it, they consider it to be, they don't call it a translation. I think they call it like a summary, but it's called the Message. And it's a very recent translation of the Bible. And it sounds, the language sounds more contemporary. There's even newer Bibles coming out. There is a Bible written by a Native American person that is written with Native American imagery in mind. So the current Bible that we have is written with like Jewish imagery, but they have translated it. So it's in English because Native Americans in America speak English for the most part, but they translated it with Native American imagery. So it has a very different feel. It's like reading a totally different book. I love it. A lot of people don't, but I love it. And they translated the New Testament.
Oh, that's interesting. I think I'm gonna have to get that. And you know, I'm gonna have to take a look at that. That kind of stuff intrigues me. I get fascinated by things like that, even when I question it and all that kind of stuff. I still do. But needless to say, the Bible and its translation is still used to curate the culture of the church, regardless as to which church you're going to. And some of the more sensitive things that we're talking about today is the culture that developed within the church around sex, sexuality, and sexual abuse within the church. And, you know, it's a very sensitive topic, but it warrants being spoken about. And I wanted to bring it here to this show because, especially at least for me and in my experience, and you can tell what yours is, older women in the church, for me, were usually the gatekeepers of church culture. And many times, they themselves, having been victims of or coping with unresolved trauma that may have occurred to them within the walls of the church, and subsequently, in some ways, become enablers for the same predators to continue this abuse to younger generations of girls and boys. And so that's why I'm glad to be having this conversation and get your perspective from the Bible Rewind. Let's start with, because we can't do this unless we talk about some actual stories of the Bible. I don't know where you want to start. I mean, we got Tamar, we got Bathsheba, we got Diane. Where you want to start? I do with Bathsheba, maybe?
Yeah, I feel considering the climate of celebrities and people with a lot of power being convicted or it's being alleged that they have committed sexual assault and they've been doing it for years.
Or settling them within 24 hours.
Yeah. Doing it for years. Plenty of people. I think King David is a great example of what power can do. When I talked to, the episode that I did about rape, it's called #MeToo Sexual Assault in the Bible. So that's the episode on the Bible Rewind. And one of the stories that I talked about with Dr. Robinson, who is an expert in the Bible, we talked about Bathsheba and David. And a lot of people don't consider that story to be a rape. So basically what happened is Bathsheba was taking a bath or doing something in her house. David, who was supposed to be at war, was at home for whatever reason in his palace or whatever. And then he sees Bathsheba taking a shower or taking a bath, whatever she was doing. And he summons her and he sleeps with her and he impregnates her. And then her husband, who was fighting the war, he calls the husband back home to sleep with his wife. The whole purpose is for the husband to make it seem like it's the husband who got Bathsheba pregnant. But the thing is, he refused to sleep with his wife because he was at war, and that would be like against his ethics as a military person. So he refused to do it. So to cover his tracks even more.
That was Uriah.
Yes, Uriah. Uriah did that. And to cover his tracks even more, David basically put Uriah on the front lines of the war so that Uriah could be killed. And, you know, subsequently, he is accused of, you know, doing the wrong thing by the prophet Nathan. And when I was a kid, there was always kind of this lingering thing, like somehow Bathsheba was responsible for like seducing David. But when you read the text, Nathan says nothing about Bathsheba. He does not accuse her of anything. He only comes after David. So he's the only one who did something wrong. And also, Bathsheba did not have the power to go to a king and say, no, I'm not going to sleep with you. I mean, this man literally killed somebody because he wanted to cover up his indiscretions, his rape. He wanted to cover up his rape. So, no. Because of the power imbalance, that's why David raped Bathsheba. That's why we consider it rape, because there is a power imbalance. Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned it that way. The way I initially, and I wanted to ask you this, is how that was initially interpreted, and you answered it. It was, at least for me when I was younger, it was interpreted as something that she did wrong. And I don't know if you can attest to this, but I recall not really getting these stories in that kind of context. Actually, I was much older by the time I got it. But even within the church, when we're talking about this power structure and this whole, it may be your fault, I recall very vividly as a young girl learning, not to be a temptress of men, you know, how you dress or wear makeup or anything like that. And I grew up in the Kojic Church, that's Church of God in Christ, where you didn't wear lipstick or didn't wear red, anything that would draw attention to your lips or your butt, anything like that. And even as a young girl, you're given these, this messaging is already there, even without you not knowing specifically when you're too young to know exactly what, you finally figure out that, okay, so if something happens to me, it will likely be because of something that I did. And have you found that to be consistent in the type of messaging that's given to young girls even before? I mean, that's pretty consistent.
Absolutely. You know, I think about a lot of times when someone has been raped, we talk about her clothing. Like, oh, what was she wearing? Where was she?
What did she put on?
What was she? Yeah, what was she wearing? As if you have to be dressed a certain way to get raped. There are these museum displays happening all over the world. And I think they're called What Were You Wearing? And it's just showing the clothing of rape victims. And it's regular stuff. They were wearing jeans and a t-shirt. They were wearing anything. They were wearing nothing that promotes promiscuity. But even if they were, that's the thing, even if they were, it's your right to wear what you want to wear. But this idea that somehow your clothing is the reason why a man's going to rape you. If you go look at those museum displays, what was she wearing or what were they wearing or the clothing of rape survivors, you will find that most people are wearing everyday clothes that you would wear to the supermarket or to school. So this, what I hate about the Bathsheba story is that Bathsheba, the impression is that she was beautiful. And that was her crime because she was beautiful. So therefore, you know, and so the church kind of tells you that if you are too whatever, to this, to that, then somehow you've earned that, you know, and that's not fair.
Yeah, you've invited this crime. You've invited this in violation. And oh, woe to the rapist. Oh, my God, look at what you've done. It kind of sets up like you somehow created this
unsafe space for men.
This unsafe space for men. Yeah, exactly. You look at what you've done to him. And it just blows my mind. And I remember still being very young that it happened to be a lot of the women, older women, who were the ones who were very much about what you're doing, what you got on and stuff like that. And this fear as if somehow you were doing something wrong by just walking in and being exactly who you are, which is a child.
Well, you have to remember that a lot of the women that told you that were probably raped themselves and they had absorbed those messages. And so they might be trying to protect you because maybe you might be able to get away. But now we know better that it's not us. We really need to work on the perpetrators.
Very much so. And which leads me to my next question. Do you know of, from your studies and your research and interviews, do we know exactly how much of this is occurring? Is there a high number? I know a lot of stuff has come to the forefront over the years through a number of churches and a lot of things have come out and cover-ups and things like that. But is there just out of my own curiosity, a stat or a statistic, or is it still something that's very shielded within the church?
Well, I mean, I don't have a stat about like sexual assault specifically in the church, but I do have a stat for Black women. I have several stats on Black women. 40 to 60% of Black women report being subjected to coercive sexual contact by the age of 18. And this is taken from the National Center on Violence Against Women in the Black Community. 35% of Black women experience some form of contact sexual violence during their lifetime. And for every Black woman who reports rape, at least 15 Black women do not report it. And so when I see these statistics, I'm thinking, yeah, because it seems like it's so much. What do you mean 40 to 60% of Black women report to being subjected to coercive sexual contact by age 18? When I think about in the podcast episode, I talk about this experience I had with when I was in college, and this was like a church thing and we were all Black, young Black women. And then the pastor asked something like, has anybody been raped or molested? And there were about 30 of us there. And of the 30 of us, only two people said they weren't raped or molested. And I was one of them out of 30. And when you're like, you know, 19, 20 years old, and you see that your peers, pretty much all of them have been raped or molested, and you're only 19 or 20, you start moving in the world a little differently. Yeah.
You absolutely do. And I think too, again, I speak from, you know, because I'm a Black woman, there's a lot, I think a lot of that gets shelled too with the sexualization of young Black girls very early on. You know, there's this sense that you're not a little girl, this sense that you, you know, somehow are just, you know, almost like a grown woman when you're 10 years old. And I think that befalls upon us quite heavily. And culturally, it also doesn't help that I remember, and I agree with you that it, women older than me or who were, you know, my age then, what I am now, were probably trying to shield and protect in the way that they knew how. And it was this real emphasis on not being fast. It was like, you can't be fast. Don't do it. It was this whole thing like this, because somehow once you become characterized as fast, like even you're 10 years old, suddenly you're fast. You kind of get relegated and subjugated to, okay, well, that's where you are now. You there's almost like a social exile, even within the church. You know, there's kind of like, she fast, she need to do this, do that. And and looking back in hindsight, I'm like, what did they do? They hadn't even done anything. We were 12. You were 10, 11 years old. There wasn't a whole lot that had happened at that time. So that number of what you're saying, yeah, that would track. That I think that would make sense from what I've learned over the years, too. I didn't find out for years later, I don't want to put their names out there, but young women that I knew growing up, how abused they had been until we were adults. We happened to get together. We just had this conversation and they were like, yeah, this was happening to us at church and in their home. And we didn't know. You had no way of knowing, but they were fast girls. You see what I mean? So all that said, when we find our way back to the church, has the church been, or at least more currently, been handling it? Do they handle it? Are people bringing this to their attention? Because I have a hard time believing that it's not known.
This is the thing. Like, when I go to church, there's certain topics I never hear anything about. Rape is one of them. I never hear anybody talk about rape. I'm not saying that, you know, there are millions and millions of churches in the world. But for as long as I've been going to church, I've never heard anybody specifically talk about rape, which is why Dr. Dominique's message about Dinah was so striking to me, because she decided to take on the topic of rape. And that's just, I think it's very uncomfortable for pastors to do that, considering that there are a lot of pastors who are also rapists. If you go online and just type pastor and rape, so many stories are going to pop up from all over the world, from all over the world. And, you know, I think with the recent stories about the Catholic priests molesting children, Catholic priests to rape nuns, and nuns having to get abortions and basically be exiled from the nun community, you know, we know about the Catholic Church, but it's the church in general, the Protestant church also. Anytime men have a lot of power and they are protected by a group of people and people will do their bidding, there are a lot of opportunities for them to abuse that power.
We're talking about the church in terms of how they have been handling these allegations of rape and abuse, and we know that they know, and their handling of it. And I know you were saying that, and this is true for me as well. I don't recall that ever being a topic of discussion. So if they're not talking about, well, maybe if they're not talking about it out loud, I doubt if they're handling it any other way, or if it's being handled behind the scenes. I don't know that to be true. And like you said, there are churches all around the world that have these things that handle them differently. But over time, we know that in some churches and some religious faiths that they have actually been looking at it. And because it's been such a prevalent problem within the church, and I don't know if they have the tools or the ability to be able to do that. I don't know if you've come across it, but I'll say this, and that this was not a topic that was discussed. And when I was growing up, and one of the things I my best recollection, even when it came to sex and sexuality, there was in certain youth groups and things like that outside of, you know, abstain, don't be fast, you know, don't wear red lipstick.
Yeah. Shaming girls for being like regular human beings.
Right.
And somehow everybody's sexuality is our problem, you know? So if you have boys who are not virgins, you're going to have girls who are not virgins, or you're going to have a bunch of women or men who are statutory rapists. See, that's the thing. Like, you can't have boys who are not virgins and then not have girls. You know what I mean? Because they're going to have sex with each other. And so I see when I was younger, I saw there was a lot more emphasis put on like girls being virgins than boys being virgins. I mean, I saw a little bit of something on the boys, but with the girls, there were like purity rings and there were just all these, like all this pomp and circumstance around virginity. And I think that makes it even more difficult to talk about rape in the church. Because even though you were violated, if you are like 14 and you get raped and prior to that you had never had sex, how do you even process that? Like, you've lost your virginity, but it was stolen.
It was stolen. And when you're in a climate, a culture where the boys are pretty much protected, I remember there was a lot of emphasis on not trying to, you know, make them look bad or put them in a position where they might get hurt or arrested or something may befall them. And so, again, it puts a lot of the responsibility upon you. And I remember in instances where people said, well, did you say no? And I was like, I don't know. And maybe I'm a little bit older, but I remember that being a thing that basically, you know, if you're scared or you're frightened and things like that, there had to be, well, she didn't say no. I remember. And then suddenly it became a big thing to be sure that you say no. And it was like, what? You know, I remember that being something that had to be spoken about. But even then, that if you have a rapist or a pedophile who is over empowering you, how do you do that? And it's not. And so I think that, and again, we're talking about the power structure. And I think a good example of that is probably the story of Tamar, where she did say no. And she was still overwhelmed.
She still got raped. You know what's crazy? Before we get to the story of Tamar, in Deuteronomy, when, you know, this is where the laws from God are shared.
Yes.
There are some interesting laws like, if a woman gets raped and she's betrothed, so that means she's probably a virgin, and she doesn't scream out. She doesn't scream out. I think she's supposed to get killed with her rapist. But if she does scream out, then she is spared. And I'm like, just this idea of, okay, you scream out, and then somebody finds you in the middle of getting raped. I don't like it. I don't like it. What if he covers your mouth?
It covers your mouth, right.
What if he covers your... What if you're like stunned and you can't even say anything?
In shock.
Yeah, I don't like this.
But it mirrors a lot of the culture of the church. It's funny that you mentioned Deuteronomy because I think that's Deuteronomy 22. I think there's even a portion where if a man happens to meet a virgin who's not pledged to be married, he rapes her and they're discovered, he shall pay her father. You have to pay for it. It's like, basically, if you break it, you buy it. You know, what is that? You know, but it's still, and that's a different passage. And it kind of just mirrors a lot of the culture in the church. And then what starts to fall over into our society structure in terms of misogyny and the course of your abuse being your fault as a woman.
Okay, so the verse that I'm specifically talking about is Deuteronomy 22:23-24. It says, if there is a betrothed virgin and a man meets her in a city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of the city and you shall stone them to death with stones. The young woman, because she did not cry for help, though she was in the city, and the man, because he violated his neighbor's wife.
Oh,
so you shall
God.
Purge the evil from your midst. Listen to this. The man, because he violated the neighbor's wife, not because he violated the wife. Do you understand?
She doesn't exist.
She doesn't. Oh, goodness. When I read those verses, I was just like, you know, when I tell you sometimes you're like, oh, I'm so happy to be born at this day and age, in this time, in this space, because it was not easy for women back then. It was not easy. was not easy at all. And it's still not easy, but imagine being them. Oh my goodness.
We're still fighting for the things. This is some of the layover. And these, now that we're talking about it, these things still fall over in very subtle ways. They still have a way of popping up and creeping in and kind of you having to fight down this perspective. The fact that we still have to, and many times, have to defend yourself in terms of your own, why you shouldn't have been abused and why you shouldn't have been raped or anything like that. It still is a reflection of what we've seen from these times. I have a hard time believing that it is not because of the how embedded it's been in our culture through our religious beliefs, through the church. That's just me personally. That's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah. So you brought Tamar up, and I find her story to be so interesting because she is the daughter of David, who, when he was younger, who raped Bathsheba. So now his daughter is being raped. And who is she being raped by? David's son, her brother, Amnon. It is like, it's incest, it's rape, it's, you know, what is it like, the continuation of a family thing?
Yeah.
And Tamar basically says to her brother, don't do this to me. I will marry you instead. So she's saying, I will marry my rapist, because she knows what it means to be raped and during that time. And he basically raped her anyway. And it's very interesting because when we first meet Amnon, the Bible says that he loved Tamar.
Yeah, he was obsessed with her.
Yeah, obsessed. You know, he was giving stalker vibes, you know? I mean, I guess he wasn't her stalker because you know what I mean? But he's her brother. But loved is such, I would be interested in what Hebrew scholars or Bible scholars who are also linguists, what they would say about that word love. What word is equivalent in English? Because I don't know if love is the right word. Because how could you rape somebody you love if she offered marriage? She offered herself to marriage. You know what I mean? So I don't get it. It's just a strange and uncomfortable story.
It is uncomfortable. You hear people, they're trying to reason their way out of. She's trying to reason her way out of this abuse. She sees it, like you said, she sees it coming. She knows what the outcome is going to be. And
he would rape her anyway. Even when they were married, he would rape her, though. That's, to me, in my opinion, I think she just wants to save her dignity because virginity is such an important thing in the Bible. And if she loses it and then she loses it to her brother and they're not even married, it's like, you know, so she basically becomes, you know, she doesn't get married or have kids afterwards, you know?
That was going to be my question. What did come of her? What happened to her? Was she exiled?
No. We don't know what happens to her at the end of her life, but right afterwards, she basically goes into mourning. And the impression I get is that she stays single and doesn't have any children. That's the impression I get. But what happens to Amnon is that her other brother, Absalom, kills Amnon. So this is like a continuation, because remember, David killed somebody too.
This family, my God.
Yeah, like the weirdest ways of dealing with problems.
Just kill him.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Absalom, even though for me, it's like Absalom is the one who makes the most sense, right? Because he's the only one who avenges his sister. And because after she's raped, she goes, lives with Absalom. So obviously she feels safe with him. Yeah. She goes to Absalom and she feels safe with him. And then it's not like the next day he kills him. He kills Amnon after a couple of years. So Amnon had a good 2 years to try to make it right. Oh, or Amnon was probably like, okay, moving on.
He ditched her.
Who knows?
I'm over it. Who knows?
Or he plotted for 2 years. They both can happen at the same time. You know, he could plot and the other one could just move on with his life. Yeah, absolutely. So Yeah, I think what is interesting about Tamar's story, the Bible does explicitly call it rape. There's no beating around the bush. It's absolutely rape.
Okay. It does. Okay. And do you think, well, I don't want to speculate on it, but I often wonder, is that because it was her brother or because it was, he wasn't a king? I don't know. I don't want to speculate on it, but is that the only instance like that where we have...
Where it's called rape?
Where it's called rape, as far as you know.
With Dinah, I believe they also say rape in some translations of the Bible. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. If this is explicitly put in the Bible, you know what rape is. The leaders in our churches have read this. They know what this is. And you know how to say the words. You know that this occurs when it is happening within the walls of your church, or, you know, in some cases, you know, the assailant may be a leader in the church, which is often, it often is a power structure or hierarchical power struggle when it comes to these types of things. But yet and still, we haven't seen, or at least I haven't seen, a growth in terms of how to address, and not just, and we're talking about rape. I mean, we're talking about the course of it, but even through just the growth of sexuality and sex, period. Because I recall when I was a teenager, not when I was young, but as a teenager, you know, there was youth groups and things like that. And the minute someone would ask about, or there'd be an inquiry about, you know, sex or something with your body, you know, outside of a young girl getting her period, you know, things like that, outside of, you know, the physiological functioning of your body, but things that have to do with sex and feelings and things like that, those youth groups or those leaders were usually like, no, that's not, we're not discussing that. I've seen it.
Yeah. In the podcast episode, #MeToo, sexual assault in the Bible, from the Bible Rewind. So I talked to Dr. Dominique Robinson, and at the end of the podcast, somewhere near the end, she says, you know, I just don't think the church is the place where these problems are going to get solved. She doesn't think we're there yet.
Wow.
And like I said, outside of Dr. Dominique's message, when she talked about Dinah, when she preached about Dinah, and this is, I was not there in person. I found it on the internet. I have never heard a pastor preach about rape. I've never heard of it. Most pastors are men. So that might be one of the reasons they might not feel comfortable with the topic, or they might be perpetrators, or they might be people hiding other people's indiscretions. Or I should say crimes. Indiscretion is too soft. The pastors might be hiding other people's crimes. Yeah. So, you know, I just don't. And it's kind of sad because the church is supposed to be like a place where people can go to have their hearts healed and feel safe. But you know how people have been talking about like church hurt? You hear that a lot with the LGBTQT plus community when they talk about like, you know, they've been hurt in church. But I will tell you that a lot of people have been hurt in church, and that includes people who have been sexually assaulted and they can't tell anybody because, like, we can't even talk about sex in like a regular sense, you know? So when we start going into the criminal actions and then you start asking girls, well, what were you wearing? Did you say no? I mean, saying no is such an interesting thing. It's such an interesting thing.
That was a big thing when I was a teenager.
It was for me too. And the problem with it is that boys don't hear the no. The men don't hear it, even if you say it, because they're being told oftentimes that, oh, she might say no, but that's not what she really means. So it's like you have to not just say no, you have to say it with a certain amount of force. And but even if you do that, you could still be raped. So once again, it goes back to how are we educating boys? And I think there are movements in at colleges and in the military trying to educate men and boys. But I don't know if it's working very well, because I saw something recently that said that rape has actually gone up.
I can see that.
I was shocked by that, actually. I was shocked.
There's a resurgence of this very toxic masculinity. And there is this, you know, this surge to try to hold on to what being a man is. And those definitions are coming through people who don't really know. You know what I mean? There's this this overwhelming need to feel like this is what being a man is, and to be anything other than that, then obviously you're not a man. You know, you fall into, you know, LGBTQ plus community, or suddenly you're just not a man, you soft. And this whole, you know, soft being a man type thing, it is. It's a real thing. And I was shocked about it too, but I think I started seeing some ebbs of it coming through a couple years ago. And I was like, oh, this is something. And then there was also kind of a browbeating on young men who aren't like that. I think this is almost kind of a flip on the what were they calling it? Like, you know, metrosexual type men who can, you know, or, you know what I mean? It looks like a backlash on that, at least for me. I can't speak to it specifically, but I've seen that. And I'm not quite sure, again, where it's coming from. I don't know, but it's actually jarring and concerning. It really is.
Yeah, it's really hard for me to talk about men issues, because it's one of these things like I can't protect or, you know, defend anybody when it feels like it's going to be to my own disadvantage or to my harm. You know, sometimes I feel like when I hear stories about men feeling lonely and they're committing suicides at higher levels and these sorts of things, and they're drifting away from like traditional things, like going to college or getting jobs and leaving their homes, like they're leaving their parents' homes. Like they're not doing that at the quick rate that we did before or that men did before. And it's like, yeah, that's sad, but I feel like, how can I know for sure that if you get back to where you were before, how can I know that I will be safe? You know, and so when the manosphere talks and they give men courage and whatever the manosphere gives men, and then it feels like that's somehow linked to rape, the resurgence of rape or the numbers going up. And it's like, we need to come up with a better solution. I don't know if we figured that out, but I do think that as women, we need to learn to protect each other. And I think, you know, when your show's called 50 Now What, right? So in one of the episodes about Noah's Ark, I talked to Brother Henri, and he is a teacher within the AME Zion tradition. And he said that, you know, well, I've attended his Sunday school classes, and he always asks, now what? So after Sunday school class, after reading the Bible, now what? And so I think for, you know, women who are more seasoned in life, when we know that these young girls are coming through and they're going to be facing some difficulties and they're going to have these stories and these hardships. And so I feel like we need to protect them, that if something does happen, because for so many women, it will happen. We want them to feel safe if they come to us. We don't want to be like our, you know, the older women in our lives when we were younger that said, well, did you say no? What were you wearing? Why were you out at that time? We want to help girls process what happened to them, feel safe to talk about it. And if they don't want to do the things that you think they should do, like, oh, well, you need to go to the police. If they don't feel safe going to the police, that's fine. That's fine. You heal the way you need to heal. And we need to be there to help them get through that. You know, I have a niece who's going to go to college next year, and a part of me is so excited for her because I had so much fun in college and I hope she does too. But a part of me is terrified, you know, because of all the things that can happen. And I don't want to like scare her, but I also don't want her to go in there ignorant either. So I think 50 Now What is, we need to protect the young ones that are coming behind us. And let them know that. And when I say protect, we can't necessarily protect them from all the men who might attack them, but we can definitely create safe spaces for them to heal. And we don't victimize the victims over and over again by asking them questions and asking them to relive their situations. And we let them heal the way they need to heal. But we're just there to be like a soft space for them, you know?
I do know. And I agree with you 150% on that. And that's why I thought it was so important to have you here, because I do feel this growing sense of responsibility to this next generation of women coming through, and not wanting to repeat and recycle again, what you said so very poignantly is the, you know, what did you do? The what did you do to incur this violence against yourself? And I think that that is just such a poignant place to land on our topic here.
But before we end, we've talked about men as perpetrators. We have to talk about women. We got to talk about the women perpetrators too.
Let's do it. Let's do it, because they do.
They do. Have you asked men at any point, like, when was your first sexual encounter? Have you ever asked them that?
Yes, actually, I have. You want me to answer for you?
Well, most of the times it's very young.
They're very young.
And the person they're having their encounters with are women or like older teenagers. From my anecdotal experience, it's like he's 10 or he's 8 and she's 19 or 20. That's from my experience from when I talk to the boys. I think that a lot of times we forget that women too can be perpetrators. And in the Bible, women are also perpetrators. You have Lot and his daughters. Lot was raped by his daughters. They got him drunk. He was the only man around. They all wanted to get pregnant. So they got him drunk and they had sex with him. Like, they literally drugged him, full out Bill Cosby, on their father.
They sure did. And we don't talk about that enough, because, again, when we talk about these young men having these perspectives on women, it starts very young with them as well. And they are encountering abuse at rates that I don't know that we'll ever truly know, because a lot of it, they always kind of feel like, well, that made them a man. You know, they're able to consider yourself that made you a man type thing. But what you were was abused. And I think that that travels with them as well. A lot of that perspective, a lot of that hardship comes along with them as well in ways that they probably don't even realize have affected or impacted them. And it's funny because, yes, it was, you know, when you ask young boys or men, when they were very young. I remember someone saying that they were 9 and it was a babysitter who was like 18 or something like that. And I'm like, really?
Very typical.
You know what I mean? They played, really? It was to show you how to kiss? Really? And I was just shocked, because I always think of, you know, abuse on a child being a man, but it is true. And I think that it enables all abusers enable each other in some way or another and continue to perpetuate that cycle. Oh, yeah, we definitely thank you for that. No, we couldn't drop the ball on that at all. Got to bring that up.
I think with because of this whole idea of boys will be boys and sexual prowess is something to be proud of. So if an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old is being molested or being, you know, coerced into like sexual situations with older people, they might not process that is wrong. You know, they might not process it. I don't know if you know the guy called Kev on Stage.
Yeah.
He's a comedian.
He's hilarious.
Yeah. He gave this story about like one of his first sexual encounters. And he was a young boy hanging out with his friends. And there was like a woman around. She was either in her late teens or early 20s. And she basically coerced them into like sucking her breast. And he thought, wow, this is great. Because, you know, of how boys are programmed, right? But then when he started thinking about it and, you know, people and he learning about what sexual assault is, he was like, you know, that was sexual abuse.
That was sexual abuse.
And I think D.L. Hughley had this story about something that happened to him when he was like a young teen and somebody, a woman, you know, was doing stuff to him and he didn't like it. But what was interesting, he like was so hesitant to call it what it was. Molestation, sexual abuse, you know, he just couldn't. And the most recent story, I think, that came out was of young Jeezy recently talked about his situation when he was young and being, you know, molested. So it's happening a lot with young men.
It's happening a lot. But I'm glad to hear them speaking out about it, because I think they were more ashamed to not speak about it because it made them feel like somehow they were emasculating themselves, that they didn't like that, or that somehow that wasn't some type of initiation or rite of passage to your manhood if you didn't get, you know, You know what I mean? If you didn't accept that as something that you should be enjoying or something that, you know, is wrong.
But it's also a power thing. If your babysitter is doing that to you, she has power over you. You know what I mean? She's older. She's the one who's watching you. And you might not feel you like, right. And so if you do have sons and you do have, and once again, 50 now what? Also, we need to give space to men who are going to come out and say, hey, I was molested, or hey, I was, you know, given a bunch of alcohol and raped. You know, I think if a 30-year-old man came out and said that he was raped because he was given a bunch of alcohol, we might be like, boy, please. But it actually happens. It really does happen. And so we have to make sure we have space for those stories too.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Yeah, that's perfect. Yeah, we absolutely do. And I'm there for it. And I'm there for it. I think that it is such an important thing for us to be dealing with. And like you said, from your podcast, from the Bible Rewind, the pastor you interviewed actually said it's not going to be handled well, but it's not going to happen in the church. It sounds like it is going to be something that we're all going to have to take our own individual, almost like a self-sovereignty, to make sure that we are individually taking some responsibility and accountability where we can and where we have the ability to do so. And also, I think there's some learning for us as well. I am still learning how to make sure that if this comes to me, how to be able to address it, what can I really lend? It is a lot of learning for all of us. You know, there is no one way to be like, okay, well, this is what, you know, I have to do. Some people just don't have the capacity to do it. But when you do, and when you're called upon, especially at this age in our lives, it's just a part of what we need to be ready for. I don't think you can be at this age and not have a sense of not just your own purpose, but a sense of your own responsibility to the next generation coming behind you to be able to address these issues when they come.
Yeah. I think for your listeners, if anybody's like trying to figure out, okay, how do I go about this? I think a great resource is the internet. The internet, there are survivors who speak about their experiences and they give us advice about what to say, what to do, what not to say, what not to do. And once again, just go on the internet and look up rape survivor stories, and things will pop up. People have written books, they have done podcasts, they have made videos. There are a lot of resources now. And of course, therapists can help you process if something has happened to someone in your family, but also if something has happened to you. Because if those statistics are true about what we saw about how many Black women have experienced sexual assault, that means a lot of us need to be healed ourselves. And sometimes I think when we're not healed, it's hard for us to help heal other people. So you can go to therapy at 50. You can go to therapy at 80 years old. It's never too old. You're never too old to like heal and ask for help. Never.
Never. And I'm a huge proponent of that. And I agree with that 150%. And I think you know that because we've talked about so much stuff before anyway.
right.
So it's not new, but between you and I. But I think that is just a wonderful message to leave with the listeners of 50 Now What podcast. And I employ everyone to listen to the Bible Rewind. It is so good. So good. And we got deep in this today, but there are some other things that that Jessica brings up on that show that you are just going to love. Absolutely just love. Thank you, Jessica, so much. Did you have any additional words of wisdom that you'd like to leave the 59 with? You've left us with it all. You've given us all the gems.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, we've said so much. And, you know, thank you so much for having me on your show. It was great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everyone check out the Bible Rewind, and we'll also have it for you in the show notes.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to 50 Now What? A special thank you to Jessica. Be sure to follow and listen to her show, the Bible Rewind Podcast. Make sure to follow us, rate, and share the show. Make sure to follow me on Instagram for continuous updates at 50 Now What Podcast. That's 50 Now What Podcast. This podcast was produced by Rainbow Creative, with Matthew Jones as senior producer, Stephen Selnick as producer, and Rob Johnson as editor and audio engineer. I love working with this team.
To learn more about making a podcast for you or your business, visit them at rainbowcreative.co.